Excellent. Thank you. Thank you both so much for your time. So just to begin, can I get a little bit of background info from both of you, where you grew up, you know, the housing situation, how you were raised, and how that kind of impacted what you do today?
Ladies first.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so I am the youngest of six. I have five older sisters. I come from a working class family from Niagara Falls. I lived in a very multiracial neighborhood and went to a multiracial school as a young kid. These weren't environments that were free of racism by any means, but in my family and in my community, having relationships with people of color, living among people of color, was very normal. And in fourth grade, we moved to Youngstown, New York, a small village in northern Niagara County. And my new neighborhood and school were almost 100% white. So there was a huge cultural shift. And the people that I was surrounded with had very different attitudes and ideas about race. Most of my classmates didn't know any people of color and got their information about race from pop culture and from their families. So racism was very normal. Sorry, 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's just some background noise. So having relationships with people of color from a young age gave me a different perspective from my classmates and an understanding that racism was not normal or okay. And I'm also gay. So growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s, where homophobia was very socially acceptable, queerness gave me access to a very intimate understanding that, hey, maybe our widely held beliefs and understandings about what kinds of people have value and what kinds of people deserve respect were incredibly harmful and wrong.
And Orlando.
All right. So I was born in Chicago, raised in Las Vegas. As a black kid, you know, I dealt with race issues, not every day, but more than half the year, I'd say. You know, there was always something on the table. I'm the middle child of three. I was homeless most of my childhood, so I got to see, you know, basically the lowest rung of society. And Vegas is very multicultural, large black and brown population, Asian population. It's very diverse. So I was around all races most of my life. The neighborhoods I lived in were primarily Latinx neighborhoods. So I got an in-depth perspective of like living in a Latinx culture. Didn't learn Spanish, unfortunately, but I know enough to be dangerous. But my experience, I had a lot of experiences with white people in general, but mainly with police officers. That's where I experienced most of my racist encounters, you know, specific instances. One time I saw people fighting and police showed up and I ran. I didn't do anything. I just was watching. And police officer ran towards me and my friend and basically said, you know, we'll shoot you if you don't stop running. So we stopped running. We were terrified. On another occasion, you know, we were grabbed and had our face put on like the hot pavement. In Las Vegas, 112 degree weather, because they thought we robbed a store when we were just sitting at a bus stop. You know, multiple occasions of stuff like that. And being a black homeless kid, being called dirty and stuff like that, whereas like my white counterparts who were also homeless were not being called things like that. And this is by staff and by, you know, staff at the homeless shelters and even volunteers sometimes, people on the street. So a lot of encounters with racism throughout my life.
Would you say that those instances with the police had a negative effect on what you thought of police and of white people?
No, because luckily my aunt was basically my grandmother. She took care of me a lot on the weekends, tried to give me a sense of like what it was like to live as a normal kid, a non-homeless kid. Not necessarily normal, we're all normal. And luckily she was a civil rights activist in Colorado. So she taught me a lot about, you know, judging people by their character and not by their color, because that's what they're doing to you and that's the part that's wrong. So every time something happened to me, I didn't judge the entirety of the group. I judged those people based on their actions. So I never felt any way, shape, or form negative about people in general. I did, however, build up a callus, an awareness of white people. I couldn't be myself around white people to its entirety because I felt as though there was something, like I was waiting for, you know, the other shoe to drop. Like there, like something might happen, so I don't want to fully express myself. When I was younger, I was a lot more reserved around white people. I was a lot more reserved around police officers. Not because I'm judging them, but just because I don't know what to expect. So until they show me their character, you know, I try to make sure that I'm safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, the term white privilege has kind of entered the zeitgeist over the past 5 or 6 years. Linnea, what in your opinion, what does white privilege mean to you? Have you seen it? Can you give me some examples of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, white privilege is an undeniable reality. White skin affords me and affords all white people an array of structural and interpersonal advantages on a daily basis, ranging from access to housing, access to resources, to like not having really specific racialized negative encounters with police or in stores. Or, you know, there's a really broad array of structural and interpersonal advantages. And those advantages compound over lifetimes and through generations. And so a lot of what we're seeing today, the inequality is not the result of, you know, one interpersonal interaction or one experience or one day, but actually of lifetimes and generations of white privilege and racial inequality.
And can you talk about the work that Surge has done to help to dismantle white supremacist systems?
Absolutely, yeah. So while white privilege is very real and is undeniable, we also live under a system of racial capitalism, which, save for the very few wealthy elites, that system actually doesn't work for most of us, white folks included. And white people's silence and complicity in racial capitalism have enabled those at the top to accumulate massive wealth while the vast majority of people struggle. So white silence is a manifestation of our privilege, our ability to look away from racism or disengage. That's afforded to us by our whiteness. That is a privilege. But our silence is also a tool that's used by elites that allows them to hoard resources while the rest of us fight over scraps. So a big piece of what Surge does, we specifically organize in primarily white communities to bring white folks off the sidelines, to break white silence and to bring them into the struggle for collective liberation, to create an economy and a world where all of us can thrive in our dignity.
And Orlando, what does... from your perspective, what does white privilege mean to you? Have you seen it? What examples can you give me?
So what it means to me, I have a really difficult time defining exactly what it means. I would say it's social, political, economic benefits or lack of disadvantages, because it's not always a benefit. Sometimes it could just be a lack of a disadvantage. All based on circumstances that have to do with having white skin. And I've definitely seen it. I've seen it. I see it every day. I mean, our president in the White House right now is the most shining and glaring example of white privilege. Basically can say whatever he wants, do whatever he wants, and maintain near a 50% approval rating. It's every day when I walk, you know, if I walk somewhere, and not walking as much these days, but, you know, if I walk somewhere, I constantly see people doing things that I can't do. For instance, if I get upset in a grocery store, I can't scream and yell, even if the situation warrants me screaming and yelling. I have to stay reserved. I have to stay calm. I have to ask. I have to follow the protocol. I have to follow the rules. I have to know the rules better than anyone else. I can't ask for the rules. I can't. So I have to exist within this humbled state, even if the situation would warrant me not being humbled. If I get stopped by the police officers, I have to immediately be aware of where my hands are at all times. I have to. It's just noticing it is just constantly seeing people doing things that I can't do, and recognizing that even with as far as I've come in life, going to law school and things like that, that people who have accomplished similar things to me are still at greater advantages because of the way they grew up. For instance, having a tutor in high school allowed someone to get into college with a larger scholarship than me. Having generational wealth allowed someone to not have to work while they were in law school. So many different things. Yes, I see it all the time. And I forget the third part. You asked the third part. What did it mean to me? How do I see it? And there was a third part.
Oh, just the examples of what you had seen, which you gave me. But I have another question from the perspective of a black man. What do you think you don't understand about white people in America?
I hate to generalize, but I feel as though there's a general sense of, I want to choose my words carefully here. I feel like there's a sense of anger when discussing black issues. And discussing the history of what white people have done to black people, I feel like there's an anger in response to that. I also feel like there's pushback because of the sense that it's happened so long ago, or, you know, thinking about slavery and Jim Crow laws or whatever it is. So the anger is one part of it. So that's something I don't understand. And also it seems like there's a compassion issue as well. Caring for things that don't necessarily affect your life, even though I think those things do affect white people, I feel like there's a compassion question there. Like, what does it take to make you care about, you know, something that doesn't affect you, or why don't you care about something that doesn't affect you? And I think the last part would be, why not respond when things are happening? There's so many situations I see where a person with white privilege could intercede and or do something that could help a situation or improve the situation. So what would hold a person back from doing that? Those, I guess, would be my general questions.
Mm-hmm. And Linnea, from the perspective of a white woman, what do you believe you don't understand about African Americans?
That feels really difficult to answer. I mean, as a person with white skin, there are millions of things that I will never understand. That just feels incredibly broad. I mean, I think both, like, my white skin and the conditioning I have, like, received as a white person it has given me so many different blinders and obstacles to understanding the reality that Black folks live in. I think there are lots and lots and lots of things that white people are taught to believe about the world from our own experience and our own conditioning that are totally not true, actually, about the world when you look at the experiences of people who are not white. So, in terms of what don't I know, I mean, there's millions of books filled with the things that I don't know. And I feel it's my responsibility, having, like, you know, inherited this legacy of whiteness, to actively commit myself throughout my lifetime to learning all of the things that I don't know and all of the things that I've been taught that aren't true, and addressing those with systemic change. I don't know anything, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. It was a very broad question.
It's okay.
So the city, this is my last question as well. The city of Buffalo remains one of the most racially segregated cities in the country. And looking through the lens of activism, Linnea, what do you think needs to be done to build a more racially harmonious and equitable Buffalo and Western New York?
Yeah, so I think in Buffalo and Western New York and across this country, we need structural change. Locally here, the legacies of environmental toxins and pollution, of economic devastation, and of racism are deeply intertwined, and we need real material transformation that addresses all of those things. And in order to understand or to address the problem, we need to fully understand its scope. Racism is pervasive in all of our institutions, from policing, education, healthcare, courts, even projects that we're told will create new opportunities and new economic growth perpetuate racism. So New York State gave $959 million to Tesla under the guise of economic transformation, and we've got a company paying $15 an hour and systematically abusing Black and Brown employees in a hostile, racist workplace. And then the 2021 budget for the city of Buffalo allocates 33% to the racist Buffalo Police Department. So when we look at how we're funding multi-billionaires, how we're giving $1 out of every $3 to a department that routinely harasses, abuses, and even kills Brown and Black folks in Buffalo, we need serial transformation. In recent months, we've seen a huge uptick in white people buying books about racism, which is great. We have a lot of learning to do, and we need to build on that individual learning to take collective action, because we need to change the ways that we respond to the conditions. But that's a step. But ultimately, we need to change the conditions that we're living in. And so as white people, we do need to do this learning about the ways we uphold white supremacy and transform on an individual level, but you can't solve structural problems with individual behavior. And our institutions and systems, they're built on racism, and that needs to be addressed. So we need transformation, we need abolition, and we need the creation of new systems that are rooted in the dignity of all people.
Well said. Orlando, I'm going to ask you the same question. Through your lens, what needs to be done to build a more racially harmonious and equitable Buffalo and Western New York?
Oh, excuse me. So, a lot of things. First of all, you need support from the local level all the way to the state level. It can't be one level of government working alone to try to end segregation. At Buffalo, you need city, county, and state level to all be in sync, which rarely happens. You need systemic reform. You need, you know, buses have to change. You need transportation in and out of the suburbs for people who want to get jobs out of the suburbs or in the city that live in the suburbs. You need to acknowledge the history of Buffalo and, like, what's happened here. Like, you have to have the conversation about the difficult conversations of, you know, racial disparities and banking. Like, Evans Bank in 2015 was still redlining communities. So, I mean, segregation is still happening in the worst kind of ways. But you got to start with the East Side. You got to invest. We need resolutions from the city saying that they're going to invest more in the East Side, the West Side. You need the county to take that $1 million that they constantly have sitting in their budget that's open for use and commit a huge portion of that to the East Side. You need the state to open up their funds to the East Side. And we need to shift from the narrative of, you know, a renaissance is happening in Buffalo to our communities in certain areas are struggling and we need to help them. We need better housing, higher quality housing. We need to make sure that renters are protected. Most of the things that you need to end segregation are things that are the same things that you need to end poverty within the city. Rent protections for renters, lower costs for rent. These are all things that affect the mobility of poor people who are overwhelmingly Black and brown people, and they can only live in certain parts of the city, which adds to segregation. So you have to improve the schools, you have to improve the quality of living, or their living situation, it's just a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, hard for me to even, to just give like five or six things because so much needs to happen. We need federal funds. We need, like, Cincinnati just got like $100 million in federal funding, you know, and like $750 million from local investors to change the way that they, to change their entire neighborhood. So, like, you need investment from, you know, all levels of government, but also all the companies that are moving in. Amazon just moved into Tonawanda. They should help provide some of the transportation funding to get workers to and from their warehouse. There's just so many different things you can do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, I want to thank both of you for your time today. And what I've been doing is giving my interview subjects just like parting words. If either of you have any parting words before we go, be much appreciated.
Let's see. Well, I didn't prepare anything. I would say, I'll just say this. I think when we talk about anything regarding improving the conditions of anyone's life, I think it's the most important thing is to include the people who are affected in the conversation, who are deeply affected. I think that's one of the most important parts of this, because if you don't know the details of how each person is affected by segregation, by racism, by whatever it is, it's going to be very difficult for you to improve their situation. And we're in a time now where a lot of difficult conversations are being had. And I just implore anyone who's having those conversations to take them seriously, to, you know, if you're not having those conversations, try to have them, and try to listen more than you talk, I guess.
All right. And Linnea.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't prepare anything either, but here goes. I think in conversations about dismantling white supremacist systems and institutions, I think a lot of white folks get really caught up on what we're conditioned to believe, that gain for someone else is a loss for us personally. And that way of thinking is itself a manifestation of white supremacy. And I would just always like to invite my fellow white folks into the idea that liberation for everyone is expansive, it's bountiful, and that a world where everyone has what they need to thrive and to live in dignity is possible. And we just have to do the work to create it together.